Hi, welcome to the MSU Libraries, Bruchim Habayim. And welcome to the first event in our symposium on modern Hebrew and Israeli literature. My name is Deborah Margolis. I'm the librarian who's been working with the Jewish Studies program on this symposium. We're very glad each of you are here tonight, and we hope we will see you tomorrow as well. So you all have this brochure, and it describes tomorrow's program, panels during the day, and then same time, same place tomorrow evening with Robert Alter. A special welcome to our guests from afar, and also to members of the community. Right, our local congregation, Kehilat Israel, will be holding a series of discussions this month on the Jewish story, including a session led by Jewish Studies faculty member Steve Weiland. And tonight, we're going to hear from a master storyteller, and we can think about what makes Meir Shalev's stories Jewish stories. The impetus for this symposium was the library's acquisition of the Irwin T. and Shirley Holtzman Israeli Literature Collection and Archive. Mr. Holtzman was a book collector and a supporter of Israeli literary culture. If you would like to get a sense of the collection, please visit the exhibit in our special collections reading room, or please ask me. This symposium was made possible by a special gift from Rita Rosenberg. I'd now like to introduce Mark Bernstein, the chair of this symposium planning committee. Mark is associate professor in the Department of Linguistics and Germanic, Slavic, Asian, and African languages, and he's core faculty in the Jewish Studies program and in the Muslim Studies program. His primary research interests are Hebrew and Israeli culture and the intersection of Jewish and Islamic civilizations. He's the author of Stories of Joseph, Narrative Migrations Between Judaism and Islam. Mark.
Thank you. Welcome, everybody. I'm really happy to see such a nice turnout, given the weather, especially. And I hear, if you can hear the thunder in the background, that'll add a little drama, I think, to tonight's speaker. I wanted to thank as well Deborah Margolis was extremely helpful in handling the planning of things from the side of the library. We also had on the planning committee several other important members: Ken Walzer, who is the director of Jewish Studies; Ilana Bloomberg, who is on sabbatical in Israel; Michael Kopish, who's here as well, and I'm leaving off Sefwa, who's here as well, won't be here today. But these were all people who spent many hours thinking and coming up with the best way to plan this and have it come off, I think, so successfully. We will be hearing tonight from our guest speaker. This is the author's keynote by Meir Shalev. Meir was born in 1948, the same year as the founding of the State of Israel. And in many ways, I think his progress is very much associated with the development of that society, a new, very new country in many ways. Those of you who have a chance or haven't read, or I would encourage you to pick up a book, read some of his amazing works. We will be having a book signing after the lecture and during the reception. You can purchase some copies of Meir's books here, and he'll be glad to sign them for you. Just also to mention, Magic Media, a local company, is filming the event, and we'll eventually have access for people who couldn't make it tonight to be able to watch tonight's presentation online somehow. In planning the event, I just want to say one of the things we started about a year and a half ago planning this event. And the first thing I had to figure out was when the NCAA finals were. And it's very good that, in some ways, I guess we weren't, MSU was not in the final. Well, maybe, if they hadn't won the final. But so this was the reason why we chose this particular day. But it also falls out very auspiciously during a very important week in terms of the Jewish/Israeli secular calendar as well. The week of beginning with the Holocaust Memorial Day and finishing with Memorial Day for Israel's fallen soldiers and Israel's Day of Independence. And we're right in that period right now. And I think it's particularly significant that we have this symposium taking place during this week-long period. It also happened to fall out. We were trying to plan things that the weather would be a little nicer, and we pushed it into April. But of course, the best laid plans don't always work out that way. So without any further ado, I don't want to take time from our speaker. Meir Shalev will be speaking on the figure of Jacob, the image of Jacob in his works. And you see up here already a copy of the Hebrew Bible, a book that's very near and dear to him. And there will be, after his talk, there will be time for questions and answers. I just want to ask again, if you, when the time comes, that you think of, try to frame your questions in as concise a manner as possible, just so that as many people can speak or have their questions answered. As I said, there will be books for sale. There will also be a dessert reception after tonight's lecture. So with no further ado, please, Mayor, come.
Thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me here. I will talk about the character of Jacob in the Bible, a little bit in my works as well. I owe you an apology before I start, because you're going to witness some horrible grammatical mistakes in the English language and lack of vocabulary. So I apologize in advance. I will apologize with a story. The story was told to me, since we discuss a biblical character. The story was told to me by... I have a microphone here, I think. Am I heard okay?
Yes.
Anyway, the story was told to me by my father, who was a Bible scholar and a teacher and a poet, at the towards the end of the Second World War. He volunteered to the British Army, served in the Middle East. His job was not very hilarious. They gave him a rifle, and he had to escort caravans of ammunition brought from Haifa port to Alexandria to the British armies in the desert, in the Western Desert. These caravans drove about a week or so from Haifa to Alexandria. So he was there sitting with his rifle. There was an English driver, and they had nothing to do, so they had to talk on the way. And in one of these drives, the driver was an older Christian English soldier, very observant, Christian person. And he was amazed by my father's knowledge of the Old Testament, of the Tanakh, of the Bible. And in the end of the journey, he hugged him and he said, "It had never occurred to me they translated this book into Hebrew as well." And so this was my apology. I can read the Bible in Hebrew and understand most of it, but English is another issue. And I'm proud to write in the Hebrew language, because I think today it's the only language which can be read and partly understood by Hebrew speakers, even though it was written 2,000 years ago or even 3,000 years ago. This is an unparalleled phenomena. As a matter of fact, if King Solomon will come into this room right now, I could talk to him. I could tell him, "I read Proverbs, your book, so-so. I read Ecclesiastes, much better. What do you think of my Russian novel?" You know, because he can read Hebrew too. So it's a nice feeling. Anyway, Jacob is the character which I find the most interesting and complex person in the Bible, maybe because the Bible gave him more space and more pages than, I think, only David has more pages than Jacob. But there are a lot of details about, not only about his character as a father of a nation, but also as a father of his own sons, and as a husband of his wives, and as a son of his mother and father, and as a brother of Esau. There are all the elements of a good story, of a good novel in Jacob's character. And lucky for us, the Bible authors have been much more liberal and opened than the Bible interpreters. And they tell us the story of Jacob with some kind of freedom that we don't find, I would say, in later interpretations of the Bible. They describe the advantages of Jacob, but also his bad traits with frankness, which is not very often witnessed in religious texts. Anyway, we know, of course, that Jacob was a twin brother of Esau, born to Rivka and Yitzhak after 20 years of barrenness. She was a barren woman. This is all our three mothers, four mothers, were barren women for a long period or a shorter period, till God listened to their prayers. As a matter of fact, there are only three women in the book of Genesis who got pregnant, I would say, excuse me for the language, but in one take. And these are the two daughters of Lot, who slept with their father, and Tamar, who slept with her father-in-law. How come, one may ask, that God punishes our righteous mothers with long periods of barrenness and gives pregnancy so freely to these sinner women who sleeps with the wrong people, with the wrong men? Which means God does have his own ways, not necessarily the ways of the people who claim to represent him here on earth. Anyway, I will, since I want to concentrate about the love life of Jacob, I want to start with the meeting he had with Rachel on the well in Eretz Kedem, in the land of the East. But beforehand, one short episode. It doesn't have to do with his love life, but with his personality in general. I would say that Jacob's life are between the two poles of practicality on one hand and romanticism on the other hand, and he moves between the two poles freely. And we can see that already when he left home. He had to run away from home after cheating his father and his brother. He had to run away from home, and this is his first night without his mother, Rivka, to whom he was very connected. It's the first time alone, first night, and he went to sleep in Beit El, where he put a stone under his neck, and he had this very famous dream of the ladder with the angels going up and down. And in this dream, God promised him all the land of the promised land, the same land he promised Isaac and Abraham before him. But notice something very important. This has to do with his romanticism. He said, I'm translating freely from the Hebrew Bible. This is something maybe that I shouldn't do in the presence of Professor Robert Alter, the translator of the new translation of the book of Genesis and other Bible book, so forgive me for this freedom. So Jacob dreamt this dream, and he saw God standing over him, and God told him, I am the God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. The land you are lying on, you are sleeping on, I will give to you and to your offsprings. This is interesting because when he promised the same land to Abraham, he said, the land you see with your eyes will be yours and your offsprings. When he promised the same land to Joshua in Joshua chapter 1, he said, the land you will step on will be your land. And to Jacob, he says, the land you are lying on, the land you are sleeping on, which means there are three ways of connection to this land. One is the sight, which is the largest land. The eye reaches further than any other organ in our body, but it is some kind of sterile, cold connection with the eye. Joshua is the general, is the fighter. He will take the land he steps on with his boots. And Jacob is the one who will have the land he sleeps on. This is the erotic relationship to the land of Israel. Some of our sages, by the way, were bothered by this promise because the land you are sleeping on is rather small, you know, is 2 yards or so, and that's all. So one of the Midrashim says that Jacob, that at that special night, God folded the promised land under the body of Jacob, and in the morning later, he opened it back so the Israeli coalition can be relaxed about this issue. But God knows that Jacob is bothered not only with the future of the Jewish people, but also with his own future, because he has to walk all the way from the land of Canaan to Mesopotamia, to the land of the east, about 1,200 kilometers, mainly in the desert, and he's worried about his own well-being. So God said, והנה אנוכי עמך ושמרתיך בכל אשר תלך. I will be with you and I will guard you wherever you go. והשיבותיך אל האדמה הזאת. I will bring you back to this land. כי לא אעזובך עד אשר אם עשיתי את אשר דיברתי לך. I will not leave you till I do everything I promised to you. And Jacob woke up and he vowed a vow to God and he said, אם יהיה אלוהים עמדי, if God will be with me, ושמרני בדרך הזה אשר אנוכי הולך, and will guard me on this road I'm walking in, and will give me bread to eat and clothes to wear, and I will come back peacefully to the house of my father, then God will be my God. First, this is the first and the last Jewish person in the Bible who opens his response to God with the word if, which means if God will not do all this, he will not be my God. Jacob is the first believer who shows us that God needs the believers not less than the believers need God. Then he adds some elements to the promise of God that God did not include in his original promise. God said that he will guard him wherever he goes. Jacob is not interested in general promises. He is worried about a specific road. He said, if he will guard me on this road I'm taking now. God didn't say anything about clothes and bread and food. Jacob adds this to the agreement between him and God. God said, I will bring you back to this land. This is too vague. And Jacob says, if he will bring me peacefully, he adds peacefully, which God did not say, peacefully, to the house of my father. Not to this land, not to the promised land, but where my family is. And this contradiction between a family and a country is important. And then he says, if all this will happen, he will be my God. So there is this romanticism of flying on the earth, having this erotic connection with this land, which will be named after Jacob, not after Isaac or Abraham. Our country is not the land of Abraham and not the land of Isaac. It is the land of Israel, which is Jacob. This is one thing, and then this lawyer-like practicality of correcting the contract and giving it back for signing. We have to remember this, because if he does this with God, he will do the same thing with people. And then he walked through the desert, and he came to this famous well, where he met some shepherds, and he was brave enough to tell them, to ask them, why don't they give water to their sheep and go to another round of of grazing. But they say that there is this huge stone on the mouth of the well that cannot be removed by one or two or three shepherds. They have to wait till all the shepherds gather around the well. This was the way to avoid stealing of precious water. Only when all the shepherds come to the well, all of them together can remove the stone, and then they can see how much water is taken by each of them. And then they said, and then he says, and here is Rachel, the daughter of Lavan, coming with her sheep to the well. ויהי כאשר ראה יעקב את רחל בת לבן אחי אמו ואת צאן לבן אחי אמו. When Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of Laban, his uncle, and the sheep of her father, which means not only the beauty of the girl, but the wealth of her father, both things are very important. He is practical and romantic together. When he saw the nice sheep and the beauty of Rachel, he did something very interesting. Jacob came to the well and removed the stone by himself. Not 10 shepherds, but one Jewish boy, which means that this journey through the desert was some kind of a journey that made him from a boy to a man, and also that the beauty of Rachel made him stronger than usual. And he gave water to the sheep of Lavan, her father. And he kissed Rachel. And he wept. And then he told her that he is the son of Rivka, her aunt. Now, I ask you, is this the right order to introduce yourself to a cousin, to a woman, to a beloved future lover, future wife? This is very strange behavior. This is a very strange and daring order of things. He should introduce himself first, saying, I am the son of Rivka, your aunt. I'm your cousin. My name is Jacob. Then they can kiss as cousins, no problem. Then he would say, may I help you with your sheep, and remove the stone and give water to her sheep. He can also weep if he wants, you know. It's an exciting moment after this long journey in the desert. But Jacob does something very daring, unconventional. He does this, I believe, not as a mistake, but as a plan he has. Because Jacob is a planner, you can see it when he cheated his father and Esau together with his mother, when he pretended to be Esau and stole his blessing. And the idea behind his strange behavior is that everything he does as a stranger. And only after he does what he does, he introduces himself as a relative, as a member of the family. So he removes the stone and shows his physical strength as a stranger. And he gives water to the sheep, which is a hard physical work, as a stranger, showing Rachel his chivalry and generosity. He kisses her as a stranger. This is very dangerous. I don't know how it's going on here, but in Israel, you are punished for such acts. We used to have a minister in the government who kissed a girl without warning and was forced to work in some works for the public. Then he weeps as a stranger. I'm sensitive too. This is what he wants to show. And then he says, I'm your cousin. So everything is clear now. He did everything as her cousin, but the first impression was already burnt into her memory, that this strange, mysterious man came from the West, did all that as a stranger. Finally, she found out it's the cousin, but this first impression became a very important element of their future's life. By the way, Thomas Mann, in his book, Joseph and His Brother, the monumental novel. He wrote, 1,300 pages from 17 chapters in the Bible. Described this very scene in the right order of things. In Joseph and His Brother, I think Thomas Mann didn't even notice the way Jacob behaves, or maybe he did notice, but he wanted to make him well-mannered. In Joseph and his brother, Jacob introduces himself first. He asks permission to kiss her. May I kiss you? I'm your cousin. May I kiss you? She says yes. Then, shall I help you with your sheep? And he gives water to the sheep. He made him an upper middle class, well-educated German boy, while Jacob is a completely different person. We have to see one other thing about the order of the acts of Jacob when he met Rachel. If we compare it to the order of actions of his father when he met his mother in the first time, this is the normal, or the way the Bible wants men to behave. When the slave of Abraham brought Rivka for Yitzhak, it is said, Vayevi'eha Yitzhak ha'ohel ha'sara imo, Yitzhak brought Rivka into the tent of his late mother, Sarah. He took Rivka and married her, and he loved her. So the order of things is first, you get a permission from your parents to these relationships. Then you marry, and only after the marriage there is love, if at all. Because the Bible doesn't see these things the way we see them today. We romantic people believe that first we have to fall in love. And then, after we fall in love, we may get married. But in the Bible, first we get married, and then we may fall in love. And love is not that necessary in relationships between the biblical men and the biblical women. The main thing of the marriage life in the Bible is bringing children into this world, is fertility, not the personal happiness of a person, of a man or a woman. We can see this even in the first chapter of Genesis, when the first words God says to humankind is, be fruitful and multiply. Not, I'm your God, and not love thy neighbor as yourself, and not even love each other, but make children, be fruitful and multiply. And this will be the main issue in the life of Jacob and Rachel as well. After a month of work, Laban, the father of Rachel, asked Jacob what is the salary he wants for his work. And the Bible says that Laban has two daughters. The elder was Leah and the younger was Rachel. And the eyes of Leah were soft, rakot. We don't know exactly what it was. What is einaim rakot, soft eyes? And Rachel was yefat toar ve'yefat mareh. She was beautiful in her look and in her, this is difficult, maybe the face and also her body, but yefat toar ve'yefat mareh is a double title of beauty. So we understand that the soft eyes wasn't something Leah was happy about, because it's contradicted to Rachel's appearance. Vayehav Yaakov et Rachel, Jacob loved Rachel, and he said, I will work 7 years for Rachel Bitcha Haktana. Rachel, your younger daughter. This, till today, is a legal expression in modern Hebrew, Berachel Bitcha Haktana, which means we notice, we read every little part or sentence in a legal document. Berachel, I will work for Rachel. Bitcha, your daughter, so you will not bring a Rachel from the neighbors. Haktana, the young one, so you will not give me the older one, which happened in the end. And now comes the verse, which I dare say, for me at least, is the most beautifully written sentence in the Bible. Vayavod Yaakov b'Rachel. I read it in Hebrew, so maybe I can deliver some of the musical aspect of this writing. Vayavod Yaakov b'Rachel 7 shanim, ויהיו בעיניו כימים אחדים באהבתו אותה. And Jacob was working for Rachel for 7 years, and they seemed to him as a few days because of his love to her. This is a novel in 10 words. You know, sometimes there are these competitions of writing novels in the SMS, on cellular phones, 140 signs. Well, this is only 90 signs in Hebrew, and it's the best novel ever written in the Hebrew language. Not one word is missing, not one word is redundant. And the content is so beautiful, and everybody who reads this sentence gets jealous. If you are a man, you are jealous because you wonder if you will ever meet a woman for whom you will work 7 years and feel it is only a few days. If you are a woman, you ask yourself if you will meet the man who will work like that for you. And if you are a writer, then you know you will never be able to write such a sentence yourself. And then you are really jealous. But I think it's a beautiful, beautiful sentence. 7 years passed. And then is the first impatience of Jacob. Because we believe that these 7 years passed as a few days. By the way, this is the title of one of my books in Hebrew. This is the one of the uses I made of Jacob in my writing, when my book, which is translated here as The Loves of Judith, in Hebrew is Keyamim Achadim, as a few days, which I took out from this verse in the Bible to show that my lover in my book has the same kind of patience that Jacob had in his in the book of Genesis. But after the 7 years, Jacob impatiently and rather rudely came to Laban and said, "Hava et ishti ki mal'u yamai, give me my wife because the time is over, ve'avoa elea, and I will come to her." This is literally, ve'avoa elea is I will come to her, but lavo to a woman in the Bible, in the Hebrew old language, has only one meaning. Lavo elea is to sleep with her. Give me my wife, the time is over, I want to sleep with her. I want to make love to her. Is this the way to talk to the father of your girlfriend? Again, Jacob loses his good manners. He's impatient. The 7 years were not few days. He was lying there on the desert stones, dreaming about her, fantasizing about her, longing, yearning all these 7 years, and now he wants her immediately. And now Laban made this feast of the wedding, and in the shelter of the darkness of the night, you remember, he sent Leah into the dark tent. And in the morning, the Bible says, "Vayehi baboker vehinehi Leah." And in the morning, it's difficult to translate whether it was Leah or it is Leah. In the morning, "Vayehi baboker vehinehi Leah." Thomas Mann says, all his life, Jacob remembered this morning when he opened his eyes and he saw in the light of dawn, of morning, that it was Leah. And immediately he realizes this complexity of this night in which Rachel is sleeping in another tent. I mean, not sleeping. She is in another tent, unable to sleep the whole night, knowing that her future husband is with her sister in the wedding tent. Leah, with him, knows that every kiss and every caress and every kind or passionate word are not meant to her, and she is not allowed to talk, to correct, to make things clear. Laban and his wife, very satisfied and happy, in their tent, they found a good shidduch for the for the girl who is not so attractive, and now they know he will work more for Rachel. And all the shepherds who sleep near the sheep are poking each other and laughing because everybody knows the trick, except Jacob. And he said to her, this is not in the Bible, but in one of the Midrashim, in the morning he said to her, Ramait bat Ramai, a liar which is a daughter of a liar, he told her. All this night, Kol ha'layla karati lach Rachel ve'at anit li. All this night, I called you Rachel and you answered me. And she said, haven't your father called you Esau and you answered him? Which means this night is the direct punishment over Jacob's behavior when he cheated his father and his brother. And now they agreed that he will work another 7 years for her. He does not have to wait another 7 years. He gets Rachel immediately, but he has to work 7 more years. Vayar Adonai kisnu'a Leah, and God saw that Leah is hated. Hated is not an interpretation. This word, hate, appears in the original text, which is a horrible, horrible word. Vayiftach et rachma, and God opened Leah's womb. And Rachel was born. Now starts a very interesting experiment run by God, in which Jacob will be educated, re-educated, and Jacob will understand what is important in Jewish biblical marriage life. Not love, not romanticism, but a family and offsprings. And there is a terrible, tragic period of about between, I would say, 5 to 7 years, in which Leah delivers one boy after the other, one baby after the other, and Rachel does not have any children. And Leah got pregnant and she gave birth to a son and she called him Reuven, because she said, Ki ra'a Adonai be'oni, God saw my misery, ki ata ye'ehaveni ishi, and now my husband will love me. This is not really a name, Reuben. It is a cry of distress. This woman who is hated by her husband says, I gave him a son. This is what women were recognized for and appreciated for in biblical life. I gave him a son. Now he will love me. And it did not happen. She got pregnant again, and she gave birth to a son, and she said, Ki shama Adonai kisnu'a anochi, God heard I'm hated by my husband, and he gave me this one as well, and she called him Shimon. This did not help either. She got pregnant again and gave birth to a son, and she said, Ata hapam yilave ishi elau, now Eli, now my husband will come to me, will follow me, because I gave him 3 sons. This is why she called him Levi. And it didn't happen. He did not change his attitude towards her. Vataharod vatelet ben, and she got pregnant again and gave birth to a son, and she said, Hapa'am odeh et Adonai. Now I thank God, which means this time there was a change in the attitude of Jacob towards Leah. Now I thank God. And she called him Yehuda, v'ta'amod miledet. And she did not get pregnant again. What happened was that God showed Jacob that he is like every other man in the Bible, and maybe not only in the Bible. There are 3 young boys in the tent of Leah. And when he finishes his day of work and he comes back to the yard, there is the tent of Leah, which is full with children, and there is the tent of Rachel, which is empty. And naturally, he goes to Leah to play with his children. And naturally, he eats dinner with his children. And eventually, he goes to sleep in Leah's tent, because this is where his children are. And this change is also understood by Jacob as well. And the next chapter opens with a horrible fight between Jacob and Rachel, not with Leah, in which Jacob loses his patience again. Vatera Rachel ki lo yalda leYaakov, and Rachel saw she did not give birth to not give children to her husband, to Jacob, and she was very jealous at her with her sister, and she told Jacob, "Give me sons, ve'im ayin meta anuchi. Otherwise I will die. Give me sons, otherwise I will die." Vayichar af Yaakov b'Rachel. And Jacob got very angry with Rachel. And he said, "Am I in the position of God? Atachat Elohim anochi? Am I like God who avoided you from having children?" The answer is a logic answer. In the Bible, it is God who decides who will give children or not. And he says, "I am not God. You have to ask him." But the anger of Jacob is not understood. Why is he angry at Rachel? We have other examples of barren women and husbands who behave much better. When Jacob's mother was barren for 20 years, Yitzchak, her husband, prayed to God personally, so he will give her children. When the mother of the prophet Samuel was barren, and she was crying and she was complaining all the time, her husband was not angry at her. He said, "Why are you crying? Why is your heart so bitter? I am better for you than 10 sons." This is not a very intelligent answer, but it shows empathy. It shows love. It shows understanding. While Jacob's answer is very impatient and very cruel. And one may ask himself, why did Jacob reacted like this? Now, the Bible has a literary policy. The Bible does not explain the psychology of the characters, the psychology of the heroes. The Bible describes their behavior, their deeds, their words. Sometimes he may say, "He was angry, he was sad, he cried, he shouted, he," things like this. But luckily enough, we have so many modern writers in Hebrew and other languages who gives us unedible amounts of psychology in their books. And the Bible is very stingy. He holds all the information for itself. The reader has to decide, or the reader has to contemplate and to guess, what is the reason for the anger of Jacob. I have an answer which suits my way of reading. And I can also tell you that I try to adopt in my own writing, in my own novels, this policy of the Bible, not to torture the reader with too much psychology, but to torture the reader with the necessity to think for himself or herself about the psychology of the readers. I think Jacob got angry at Rachel because the whole situation showed him that he is just another man like all other men, that he appreciates the wife and the children and the tent with the family. And he lost his romanticism near the well and along the 7 years. Somehow I feel, in a way, that Jacob, as a nice Jewish believer, used to read every night before he went to sleep, used to read a chapter in the Bible, like we should, you know? And when he was reading this chapter, when he came to this beautiful verse, and Jacob was working for Rachel for 7 years, and they seemed to him like 7 days because of his love to her, he used to tap his own shoulder and says, "This is about me. This beautiful verse is telling my story." And now he saw that he's not like this anymore. He is like any other man. He got married, he has children, he has mortgage, He has a steady job with his father-in-law. There is something which he did not expect. He liked this position of a romantic person, and he is not anymore. When Rachel finally gave birth to Joseph, she gave him this name. Again, it's a some kind of play of words in the Hebrew language. She said she called him Joseph because God removed her shame, and because she said, God will add me another son. And we know now that after Joseph was born, his love to her came back immediately. Again, the Bible doesn't say it specifically. It doesn't say, and then he started to love Rachel more than he loved Leah, as it was before. But there is a story about the meeting between Jacob and Esau 20 years later. 20 years later, after this cheating of the father and Esau, Jacob came back from the land of the east to the land of Canaan, his land, his promised land. And on the way, he had to cross through Esau territory, and he was really worried and afraid. And he prepared his family and his stock, his cows and sheep and goats, towards this meeting. And he sent flocks of herds of cows and sheep to Esau to appease him. And then when he saw Esau coming towards him with 400 men, which is a mighty military power at this time, he divided his family. He divided his 11 children, Benjamin was not born yet, so the women slaves and their children were first. If Esau will be aggressive, they will be hit. And then it was Leah and her children. And then Rachel and Yosef, achronim, and Rachel and Joseph, the last ones, most protected. So if anybody in Jacob's family asked himself, as children often ask, who does father love more? You know, this is where they got the answer. It is not only that he loves Joseph more than Reuben or more than Naphtali. He appreciates the life of Joseph more than he appreciates the life of Judah and Dan and Gad. This is a very cruel moment in the history of the family of Jacob. And in general, one may say that our fathers, the three fathers, also Isaac and Abraham, not only Jacob, were great fathers of the people of Israel, but very bad fathers of their own children, one generation after the other. And this is the example of Jacob. Usually, we talk about the shirt or the skirt. Ktonet ha-pasim, איך אני מתרגם? The coat of many colors that Jacob gave Joseph, the coat of many colors, and the other brothers got jealous. But this is stupid. This is something that can be easily corrected. But this event, when he protects Joseph more than he protects the other children, this is something that will never be corrected. This is something where he really tells the truth to the other members of the family. Rachel died when she gave birth to Benjamin. ותמות רחל ותיקבר בדרך אפרתה היא בית לחם. She died and she was buried on the way to Ephrat, which is Bethlehem. And Jacob put a stone on her burial site. This is the burial place of Rachel till today. This is an interesting story, telling us that the grave of Rachel was an important site already in the Bible, not later. The trouble is, by the way, that the tomb of Rachel is mentioned here in the book of Samuel, and in the book of Jeremiah, and when you read the three places, you realize that we are worshiping the wrong place today. She should be buried a little east of Ramallah, in the West Bank. This is how Jeremiah and Samuel describe the place. But I mean, if you're used to the bunker we pray today, and you can keep on doing this. I don't mind personally. It's for me. I, by the way, am looking for the graveyard of Tamar, because she is the real mother of Israel today. This woman who slept with her father-in-law and gave birth to the whole tribe of Judah, she is our mother. Because most of the Jewish people who are in this room belong to the tribe of Judah, because the 10 other tribes got lost. We don't know whether to be happy or sad about it, but they got lost, and we have the tribe of Judah, a little of Benjamin, and Levi and Shimon, who can be recognized by their names and by their temper too, from time to time. I will get back to our story. I see my watch, and I will go towards the end of this talk. After her death, Rachel is not remembered anymore by her husband till his very last days in Egypt, when he came down to Egypt after Joseph was discovered as the high-ranking Mishne Lamelech Paro in the land of Egypt. And we now come to the last days of Jacob. He visited, his son Joseph came to visit him with his two sons, Ephraim and Menashe, who were considered by Jacob as his own sons. And while talking to Joseph, he said, "V'anochi miboi bevoi mipadan." When I came from Padan, this is the land of the east, Rachel died in the land of Canaan, on the road, when we had a little to walk towards Ephrata. And I buried her there, Bederech Ephrat, on the way of Ephrat, which is Bethlehem. And then he saw the sons of Joseph, and he said, "Who are these?" But it is right after he saw them, and he said, "These will be my children," which means he's a little in some kind of delirium, maybe because of old age, maybe because of sickness. But still, he, in the next chapter, he blessed the 12 sons, which will become the 12 tribes, one after the other. And the last paragraph of this blessing refers to all of them together. And this is very interesting. He said, "Ani ne'esaf el ami," literally, "I am collected to my family." Am in the Bible is not only nation, but also a family, which is a nice expression in Hebrew of dying. "Bury me with my ancestors in the cave of the field of Ephron the Hittite, in the cave Asher Bisde HaMachpelah." This is Me'arat HaMachpelah, the cave of the patriarchs. "Asher al pnei Mamre be'eretz Knaan," in Mamre, in the land of Knaan, "which was bought by Abraham from Ephron the Hittite as a burial ground." He repeats again and again the same information so that they will know exactly where is the place. "Shama kavru et Avraham ve et Sara ishto." This is where they buried Abraham and his wife Sarah. This is where they buried Yitzchak and his wife Rivka. "And this is where I buried Leah. And we bought this, Abraham bought this, the field and the cave from the Hittite people," and these are his last words. And the question is, again, the Bible does not explain it, why did Jacob ask to be buried next to Leah and not next to Rachel? So who is the beloved woman in the end. So there are many explanations to this. One, the scientific explanation would be that naturally this paragraph was written by a writer who belongs to the tribe of Judah, and he wanted to praise his mother, Leah, because Rachel is the mother of Joseph, of Ephraim and Menashe and Benjamin. The other one is that Jacob cannot be buried in another place. I mean, the Jewish people need the whole holy family in the same cave. This should not be done. If we bury Jacob in another place, then it will reduce the importance of Me'arat HaMachpelah. So there is another question, why didn't they move the bones of Rachel from her burial ground to the cave? Such things were done in biblical times. Bones were moved from one place to another. It's done today as well. It can be done. But there must be also a literary, psychological, personal question to this, not only the national, historical, spiritual answer. Why did Jacob, the private person, the husband, the father, not the patriarch, not the man we are all named after, why did he want to be buried next to Leah and not next to Rachel? And again, we have to guess, because the Bible does not explain anything. My guess is that Jacob wanted to lehanziach, to immortalize the 7 years of separation he had from Rachel. The years of separation, of longing, of yearning, when they were apart. He does not want, after his death, to be next to her. He want to be far away from her, the way they were before their wedding. Because I believe he knew, as an old man, that these were the years in which he loved her more than the other years in which they were together and married. There is something, I would say, very cruel and even infantile in this kind of thinking. When romantic men idealize separation and longing and yearning, because they are too lazy to build proper marriage life, you know? So they have this romantic feeling about, oh, I missed you so much, I missed her so much, how great it was, how meaningful it was, how important for me as a lover, as a romantic person it was. On the other hand, by saying this, he also gives his sons, who are the people of Israel, who are us today, a very interesting will. He says to us, to his offsprings, in the many generations to come, remember this element of yearning and longing and of not fulfilling, of not having and not possessing everything. You have to, he tells his son, you have to keep this element in your life. We did keep it in our messianic belief, because every Messiah which appears in our history is denied automatically. We don't want the Messiah to come. We want to wait for the Messiah. This is the big idea of the Messiah. If Messiah will come, he will destroy this whole pleasure of waiting. So in this, I think Jacob was very clear. On the other hand, as we know, there are things in our lives in which we are not able to wait and to pray and to long and to yearn. And this is something we have to listen to this father of ours, to Jacob. When we finish reading this story of Jacob and his two wives, we realize that again the Bible wrote a story, gave us a story which was written by men, described men, and was directed to male readers, mainly. Most of the writer, most of the Bible is like that. There are a lot of stories about the respect the Jewish religion feels towards women. It's not in the Bible. We have several, and one may say, even today we still, a lot of improvements should be made in this respect. In the Bible, women have to serve their husbands, give them children, support them, feed them, take care of them, work for them, and the feministic ideas are not there in the Bible. We have some outstanding ladies in the Bible, but they are the outstanding ladies who prove that the other ladies are not like this. But we had this poetess Rachel Amshoreret, who was named like any other Rachel after the biblical Rachel, who wrote a poem about her own lover. And the last words of this poem are Achakelecha ad yichlu yamai kechakot Rachel ledoda. I will wait for you till the end of my days, as Rachel waited for her beloved man. And this is something that only a biblical interpreter, as Rachel the poetess, not only a distinguished poetess, but also a woman who knows this element in Rachel's life from her own experience. What she says is something that no interpreter said before, that Jacob was waiting for Rachel for 7 years. She was waiting for him all her life. I thank you for listening to me. And if you have any remark or a question, I may try and answer. But just remember, I did not write this story. It's not done.
As I said,
it has to do not only with Jacob, but also with the people who wrote Jacob. And the people who wrote the story of Jacob has their own ideas. And the idea may be either that they have to praise the tribe of Judah and the mother of Judah, which is Leah, and not Rachel. And also that we must have all three fathers in the cave of the patriarchs, because otherwise it's not the cave of the patriarchs, it's the cave of only two patriarchs. So I think this is the reason, the historical or political reason, that Jacob asked specifically to be buried next to Leah. And by this, the descendants of Leah said to the other parts of the Jewish people, he preferred our mother. In the end, she was his beloved wife, and not Rachel. And this happens from time to time when people write biographies or autobiographies, and they make these kind of corrections even in their own family while writing. So.
When Jacob meets Pharaoh at the end,
yes,
he gets introduced to him, and he says that the days of his life have been miserable and short and wretched. And this is a man who has contracts with God, who talks with God, who's protected by God, and has lived a long life and has many children, and yet he feels his life has been miserable and wretched. What's that about?
You know, again, I think it's one of the most important sentences in his life, because the writer says the writer gives a lot of respect and honors the personal feelings one has towards his own life. And sometimes you can look upon a person and tell yourself he must be very happy. He has this beautiful house and beautiful wife and three cars and a very good job and is very successful and is very famous and whatever. And this man may be inside himself, in his own heart, maybe very sad. Maybe he doesn't have a reason to that. Maybe you say there are little children are dying of hunger in Africa and you are frustrated because you couldn't write the Ninth Symphony or something like this. But still, you have to respect the feeling of a person. I think Jacob said that his life were short because they were shorter than the lives of Abraham and Isaac before him. Abraham was 175, Isaac I forgot. And Jacob died in a younger age. I mean, an age we will all be happy about today, but still younger than his father's. And when he says that his life were ra'im, bad life, I think he refers to all the troubles in his own family. In his own family, there was not only the tension between the two wives, but also the tensions between the sons. Now, he has one son who slept with another wife of his, Bilha. He had his two sons, Shimon and Levi, who made this horrible pogrom in Shechem and made him an enemy of other people. He lost Joseph for many years, thinking he was dead, and then found him again. He lost Rachel in a young age. She died by giving birth, which means she was a young woman. He had a lot of tragedies in his life. And maybe he did not enjoy the status of being the father of Israel enough to forget these personal troubles. And I think it is very nice, and in a way it's a refreshing attitude of the biblical author, who says all these big characters of our past, all these patriarchs we have, also had private lives, and we have to appreciate their private lives as well. Yes, please.
Yes, I'd like to explore with you
more Jacob's romantic side. Mm-hmm. Thomas Mann talks about Jacob and his relationship with Joseph.
Yes.
And their love to talk about the cosmology and to talk about the spirituality and philosophy and so on. And Jacob and Jacob encourages Joseph in his dreams, says, it's wonderful, these dreams that you have. Just don't tell your brother about the dreams, which, of course, Joseph can't resist doing.
Yeah.
But then, of course, when Jacob loses Joseph, he's lost that part of his life. Joseph is the only one who he can share this special quality with.
Yeah.
Could you explore that?
Yes, I have something to say about it. First, you can see that Joseph was not only the son of the beloved woman, but he was also the son who, in a way, resembled Jacob more than the other because of this ability to dream. Remember that Jacob started as a dreamer in Beit El with the ladder and the angels,
and now Joseph started to dream his own dreams, and he was later capable of solving dreams for other people. So it is the only son who has a connection to the dream element in the life, which Jacob possesses. Jacob dreamt more dreams than after the ladder and the angel's dream. Another thing that also Thomas Mann wrote and this is even more romantic, Thomas Mann invented, I think, I never found it anywhere else. He took some of our midrashim into this book, but this story, I think, it's his own midrash, and I think it's one of the greatest midrashim about Jacob's life. He said that the coat of many colors he gave to Joseph was the wedding dress of Rachel, and when Joseph put it on, he looked exactly like his mother. And because even our sages also said that Joseph and Rachel were looked alike because both of them are described in the same words, Yefat Toar v'Yefat Mar'eh, Yefet Toar v'Yefet Mar'eh. So they gathered, they looked alike. And this chapter where Joseph wore the dress of his mother and looked like her, and Jacob looked at him and saw Rachel coming up, the dead wife materializes in front of his eyes, is one of the most touching chapters in Joseph and his brother. Also, the similarity between parents and children is important in the families of our fathers. In the story of Rivka and Yitzchak and Esau and Jacob, because the Bible said, "Vayehav Yitzchak et Esav ki tzayid befiv." Yitzchak loved Esau, preferred Esau because he brought him game, meat, from his hunting. Verivka ohevet et Yaakov, and Rebecca loved Jacob. So, there is a reason to the love of Isaac to Esau, which means this love can stop at any given moment. But there is no reason, the love of Rebecca to Jacob is unconditioned. She loves him not because he brings her or gives her something. And one may ask, why does Isaac loves Esau and Rivka loves Jacob? And I think that each of them loved the son who resembled him, that Jacob resembles Rivka and Esau resembles Yitzchak. Esau resembles Yitzchak in this aspect that they both of them do not have the ability to postpone satisfactions. The effect of the smell of the lentil stew on Esau is similar to the effect of the smell of the grilled meat upon Yitzchak. As for Rivka and Yaakov, well, they are the greatest couple of mother and son in the Bible, both liars, both tachechanim, intriguers. In this story of cheating the blind old father, using his blindness in order to achieve the better blessing for Jacob, when she told him she's the mind behind the scheme, and when she tells him what to do, then Jacob has some kind of reservation from her plan. One would expect the father of Israel to say, "This is something that should not be done. You know, we should not cheat the old blind father like this." No, the only reservation Jacob had was ulay yemusheni avi. He says, maybe my father will feel me. And because Esau was hairy and he was smooth, vehayiti be'einav ki meta'atea, and he will understand I'm a liar, and he will curse me instead of blessing me. And then his mother says, your curse is on me. Don't worry. Your curse will be on me. This is a great couple of a mother and a son. They think alike, they act alike, and it comes from the family. You can see that Lavan too is a liar, a professional liar. The whole branch of the land of the East produced liars, and you know, this is what I said in the beginning of my lecture, that the Bible is opened and liberal and does not whitewash these irritating details from our history. It's only the later interpreters who try to do it. Yes, please. Ah.
I very much like the verse to Kiyamim Achadim. So here are two thoughts about it. First of all, I'm not sure about the impatience there, especially whether it was directed towards Rachel or towards the liar Lavan. I think the problem of Yaakov at this stage was not with Rachel. I mean, he was still patient. He would work another 10 years for Rachel. he didn't trust his father-in-law or his future father-in-law. So when he says Havai tishti ki malu yamai, he knew that there was a serious risk that Lavan wouldn't give him Rachel. So the impatience was directed towards Lavan, not towards Rachel. And I wouldn't make too much about this avoa elea, which maybe might sound to us a bit rude. I think in the Bible it's not that rude to talk about these things, and it's clear when you marry somebody, that's the purpose of it, so that's okay. That's one. The second is, if I'm not mistaken, and there are experts here to correct me, the expression yamim achadim appears only one other time in the Bible, in the book of Bereshit, when Rebecca... Okay. Yes. Now, since this is the only two places where this expression appears, I wonder whether there's any connection we should, anything to learn from this, especially as it's quite clear that in the case of Rebecca, she doesn't mean one or two days. She means a significant time, because the idea is we need Esav to calm down, and that would take more than several days.
This is, I don't remember exactly.
It's the end of Parashat, Parashat Vayetze.
Yeah, about the first thing, well, you know, this is the one thing I really love about reading the Bible today, is that we can understand the text of the Bible in very different ways, and I think your interpretation is very nice and very logical. I still think otherwise, but we can argue about it as much as we want, and the Bible will not solve the problem, because and I'm sure that other people will still. But where do you see Kayamim Achadim in?
24, I think.
Pardon?
Chapter 24.
24. No, this is. Okay, there is Kiyamim Achadim with Jacob working in.
It's after stealing the blessing.
Okay.
Where Rebecca says to Jacob, I heard that Esav is planning to kill you, so you better run away to brother.
Yeshavta imo yamim achadim.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's the only other place in the entire Bible where this expression appears.
Yeah, but maybe she didn't, maybe here, yamim achadim, she says to him, Rivka says to Jacob, after Jacob got the better blessing from Isaac, Rivka told him, get up, run away to my brother Lavan, sit with him, yamim achadim, few days, till the anger of your brother will calm down. One cannot know whether she means a long period of time, or maybe it takes a shorter.
You won't have to stay away long. It could be interesting. You won't have to stay long.
Yeah.
He's trying to encourage him. You're only going to come out a little while. Until he calms down, then you come.
Yeah. But the little while is definitely more, it's not a several days.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Now, yamim is often in the Bible years, isn't it?
It can be too, but still, since in the text, in the verse I was praising so much, that the 7 years seemed to him as a few days, this must be a short period of time. This is the essence of the text. But in the other sentence that you mentioned...
The phrase also, I just think, the kayamim achadim is highlights the subjective experience of it, I think, as well. They were in his eyes as a few days, rather than...
When I came with this title to my publisher in Israel for my book, Kayamim Achadim, he said, this is a horrible title, because it sounds terrible. And he was right. Till today, when people in Israel talk to me about this book, they never say the correct title of the book. Not Kayamim Achadim. They say, Kama Yamim, Yamim Achadim, Hayu Yamim, all kind of expressions with the word Yamim. Nobody says Kayamim Achadim. So I said, no, but I want this title because of the association to the biblical Jacob. He said, why don't you remove the K, only Yamim Achadim, few days, this is simpler. He said, if I remove the Kaf, then this association from the Bible will not be recognized. And he said, and how many people will recognize it with the K? I had to admit that few people. But still, I said I have to respect these people, and I want this title. It's not the only biblical title I have. There is another novel that was not translated yet to English called Beveito Bamidbar, In His House in the Desert, which is taken from the burial of Yoav, the general or the minister of defense, I would say, of David, who was killed by Benayahu, Vayamot, Vayikaver Beveito Bamidbar, and he was buried in his house in the desert, which I think is a very nice way of describing the personality of this man. And Esau, of course, I have a novel called Esau, which in a way is influenced not only by the Bible, but also by Melville, by Moby Dick, which opens maybe in the most famous opening in literature, Call Me Ishmael. So when I titled this book Esau, in a way I said, Call Me Esau, because it cannot be the real name of a Jewish person. Nobody calls his son Esau in Judaism. It's like calling your son Haman or Amalek. Esau is not a positive character in our history. So if the title is Esau, it means this is not my real name, but I want to be called Esau.
I hate to pick on very small points. Actually, I love to pick on very small points. At the beginning of the talk, you talked about the use of the word im.
Yes.
As meaning if.
Yes.
It's unambiguously true in modern Hebrew that it's if. But many commentators have been so horrified by the seeming attempt of Jacob to play let's make a deal with God that they translate it in a rather different way in the Bible, that is like ki'im, or because, or surely because, and not as a conditional zatalui. And I wonder if you'd comment on that difference, why you so unambiguously go for if when others are willing to see it more in a
first, because I also like to pick on things, not so, and I think this is a very nice topic to pick about, but still, we have to look at the whole sentence. It's not, you have to see not only the beginning of the sentence, but the end of the sentence. So he begins by saying, if God will do this and this and this, v'haya Adonai le'Elohim, then he will be my God. So it is a condition. Whenever you have a condition, you have the two wings of a condition. If that, then that. So we have the word if, and we have the then that in the end. So I guess this is the way I read it. And I also understand the agony of religious interpreters when they read this this sentence. I feel in a way that God was really happy to hear this sentence from Jacob, after he was bored to death, I think, from the blind obedience of Abraham. Whatever he told him, he did. Never argued. He argued only about one topic. He did not argue about sending Ishmael away to the desert. He did not argue about sacrificing Isaac. One thing he argued was the number of just people in Sodom that may save the city. And even in this argument, he did not dare to come to the bottom line, which is one just man in Sodom. He stopped it, I think, at 20? 10? At 10? There is no principal difference between 30, 20, or 10. There is a difference between many just people and one single just man. And God, in a way, when you read this chapter, you see that God got, in a way, something between bored and angry, because he just got up and left in the middle of this argument. Yes, please.
Absolutely wonderful. Could you say a word about Joseph and his brothers? Not the man,
okay,
but the Bible. I'm interested, though,
I can say, I think Joseph is the greatest example of tikkun in the biblical stories. Tikkun, correction, is a very basic idea in Judaism. Is the process you go when you correct something which was wrong. Now, Joseph, as a young boy, was spoiled, annoying, unbearable young brother. I think that the dreams he dreamt about, that the sun and the moon and the stars are bowing to him, I think he made them up. I think he never dreamt them. He made them up to annoy his brothers, and he was very good at it. And his father preferred him. We know this by the description. He was a younger, he was very beautiful, he was more intelligent than all the rest. There was something very annoying in his being, and as he behaved like this, of course, his conduct was very annoying. I think the years in Egypt, the agony of being enslaved, imprisoned, away from his family, were in a way purified him, made him not only Joseph the wise man, he's the first wise man of the Bible, but also Yosef HaTzadik, the righteous person in the positive way of reading it. And I think from a very annoying, spoiled boy, he became a very good, productive mo'il, how shall I say? A positive man in society. Look, we have two very wise men in the Bible. This is Joseph and Solomon. And if you compare their wisdom, you can see that Joseph's wisdom is channeled into the well-being of the public, of society. This is how he saved not only Egypt and the Egyptian people, but the whole Middle East from hunger by his wisdom. And the wisdom of Solomon was empty. It's a wisdom of a man who wants to impress other people with his proverbs, with his knowledge. All the kings from the area came to listen to his wisecracks, you know. But he didn't do anything positive to the people, to his nation. The one thing which he did, building the temple, was also an idea of his father, not his own idea of David. And when you see the difference between the wisdom of Joseph and his wisdom, for me it's something very meaningful. And you know, if I was Joseph's brother, one of his brothers, I guess I will be very angry at him too when he was young. I don't think I will do the same, like selling him to slavery, but he was really an annoying boy. Not pleasant to live with in the same house. We have, you know, everybody knows such people, such little children, you know. And some of them stay like this all their lives, and some of them change, like Joseph. Yes, please.
I just wanted to ask you, you promised you would speak mostly about, you said you were going to speak about Jacob in the Bible, but I want to hear about Jacob in your own works as well. If you could talk, okay. I was thinking of the two Jacobs that are in Roman Musi.
I have several Jacobs in my books. In my first novel, Roman Rusi, a Russian novel, here it is called The Blue Mountain. Jacob is the grandfather of the narrator and also the teacher of the narrator. And I gave them this name because for me they were some kind of, not fathers of a nation, but fathers of a new nation. Because these are the people of the Second Aliyah, the pioneers of the Second Aliyah, who built a new society. In Palestine, and this is why I gave them the name Jacob, to show their status as forefathers of the present day Israeli society. Then I have a Jacob in Keyamim Achadim, in the Loves of Judith. Horrible title. It's called, it has a better title in England for the same translation, Four Meals. Yeah. This in here I called one of the, there is a woman in this book who is courted by three men. One of them is a Jacob. The other one is a cattle dealer called Globerman and a farmer called Rabinowitz. And the third one is a canary grower, handler, who is called Jacob. And this is where I wanted to say that also pick on the verse you quoted about the miserable life of Jacob, but also about his patience. He says there in one of his monologues that he says, when God gave wisdom to the people, I was the last in line, he said. But when he gave them patience, I got it all, because everybody else lost their patience and went away. So I got all the patience God had to give. And he waited for his beloved woman even more than the biblical Jacob. But he also said in one of his monologues that Jacob, he said, us Jacobs, from the biblical Jacob till me, he says, we never had it easy when it has to do with love. Whenever there is love, a Jacob will suffer. This is how he sees it. I guess there are Jacobs in this hall here, so I don't want to be to generalize that much. But still, this is the way he feels, that Jacobs cannot have easy or a normal love life. And I want to mention this technique of the Bible of not explaining the psychology of the characters, and this is also something I try to do in my own book, my own books. Good. I think I really enjoyed talking to you, and thank you very much.
Thank you. I think we all had a wonderful experience of seeing what really in a Jewish learning in a broad sense can be like, bringing the Bible into modern Israeli Hebrew literature. And Mayo is obviously the person very well equipped to do that.
Thank you.
I want to welcome everybody to a reception and your chance to meet with Mayo. He'll be signing books at the back, and to interact with any of our other guests who are here for the symposium. And please come tomorrow too, if you can. We have events throughout the day, and Professor Robert Alter's talk again at 7:30 in the same location tomorrow night. Thank you.
Thank you very much.